This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, it's Duncan McHugh in for Pia Chattopadhyay. Every Wednesday, we bring you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from this week's edition of the Sunday Magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or worth hearing again. You can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. No matter where you are in Canada this summer, here's hoping you get to spend a little time on or in the water. Whether it's paddling a canoe or jumping off a dock, the water is always a place to find some peace and quiet. Though, according to my next guest today, there's actually a lot more sound going on in our waterways than you may ever have imagined. Science journalist Amarina Kingdon has been spending a lot of time listening to the underwater world lately. And what she's heard is eye and ear opening. She has a new book called Sing Like Fish, How Sound Rules Life Underwater. And she has a warning, too, about the way human activity is altering the delicate soundscapes beneath the surface. Amarina, welcome to the Sunday Magazine.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start this off the way you start your book. It's this lovely scene with you and your brother playing in a lake, and then you're playing with a truck under the water, and you start yelling at each other under the water, and, and you can't really hear each other very well.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have an experience kind of like that when they're young. Either they're, you know, swimming in a pool, or, you know, they're rinsing their hair from shampoo, or in our case, we were huge Tonka truck fans. And so what we used to do is we would drive our trucks around roads, and we'd build houses and build little cities. And so one day, it was summertime, just like it is now, and we kind of threw our trucks off of the dock into the lake, and we started to drive the trucks around the bottom of the lake, because we thought, oh, this will be fantastic. We can bulldoze down all the weeds and we can, you know, scoop out all the fish nests. And while we're down there, being kids, of course, we start yelling at each other. And I see my brother, Wes, have this stream of bubbles come out of his mouth, but I can't hear him. And, you know, I try the same thing. And soon we realize, like, we can't hear each other at all. And then Mom comes down to call us for lunch, and we see her kind of like standing on the dock, and she's waving her arms, and we know she's saying something. We can't hear a thing. So the first thing we do is we, of course, yell all of the bad words that we know,
right?
Because we're 6 and 7 and 8. But eventually we just kind of stopped doing this game, because at some point we realized, well, we can't really communicate. So there's nothing down here. And I think a lot of people have this idea in their head that their sound doesn't really work underwater. And I think that was really reinforced by there was a film put out in the 1950s, a very famous film by Jacques Cousteau, the explorer, literally titled The Silent World, about the ocean. And this idea that sound just doesn't work underwater just kind of gets in there and it doesn't really leave, because that's our human bias.
But that's not the case. Sound does work underwater.
It works really well underwater. It's interesting because our ears are adapted for air. So our ears work really, really well in the air. But ears actually evolved about 450 million years ago in the water. And if you were to look at all the senses that animals use in the water, there's not very much light compared to above the water. And as far as chemicals and scent, they don't diffuse as easily, because water is a lot more dense than air. So it absorbs a lot of light, and it doesn't spread chemicals very well. But sound, because of that additional density of water, it actually goes really, really fast, and it goes a lot further. And so underwater, if you're an animal trying to figure out what's going on around you, sound is actually kind of, for many animals, the sense of choice to figure out how to survive.
Can you give me a really quick physics lesson here? I mean, how are the properties of sound underwater different from the air?
Ooh, that's a good one. Well, apologies in advance to the physicists who are probably going to point out about 6 million oversimplifications. But essentially, because water is denser, sound is going to move through it quicker. And that's because sound is essentially a pressure wave. So it starts when the source vibrates against the molecules, and sound can move through anything that can compress even a little bit. So in air, in water, in solids, in air, it goes about 330 meters a second. Underwater, it goes about 1.5 kilometers per second. So that's like 4.5 times faster.
Wow.
If you could put your head in stainless steel, it goes 5 kilometers a second, which is super fast. So underwater, you have this vibration that starts a wave of pressure that spreads out and moves around. And basically, because the molecules are closer together, it's able to move easier through water. And at the same time, it degrades slower. So if you have a sound in air that goes, you know, a couple hundred meters underwater, it could very easily go a couple dozen kilometers.
Okay, I'm imagining these pressure waves that are going through the water, but human-centric question here. Fish, other marine animals, don't have ears, or most don't. So how are they hearing or communicating the sounds?
Well, fish actually do have ears, which was something that I did not know myself. Fish evolved the first ears, or the ancestors of fish evolved the first ears about 400 and some million years ago. And so most vertebrates, which is an animal with a backbone, will have ears. So that's reptiles, amphibians, birds, and mammals like us. So an ear, as I learned, is actually any organ that is specifically devoted to perceiving sound.
So, any organ?
Yeah. So it doesn't have to look like our ears. It just has to be the same function of like just listening to sound. However, about 90% of the species in the ocean, and in fact, more than that in the world, are invertebrates. So they're things like squid, mollusks, octopus, crabs, lobster, and they don't have anything that we would call like an ear, but they still have organs that are capable of detecting sound as well. And so it gets kind of complicated, but at the end of the day, what you find is that pretty much every animal, whether it has ears or not, and whether those ears look anything like ours, they're capable of detecting sound and capable of tapping into that information stream.
Okay, I want to walk you through some of the underwater animal kingdom here. You've brought some underwater sound, animal sounds for us. Let's play the first one.
Sure.
Okay, what's that?
That, I believe, is a killer whale, and that is a specific kind of call called a pulsed call. And killer whales are a kind of whale that scientists call a toothed whale. So they're the odontocetes who can click and echolocate for their food. And they make kind of three super broad categories of sound. And sometimes those categories merge into each other. But basically, they can click, they can whistle, and then they can make what you just heard, which is like a pulsed call sound. And that's the most complex kind. You could say it's the most complex kind. And killer whales, because they're mammals, they have really strong social bonds. And underwater, most animals find that just like sound is the best way to find out about your world, sound is also the best way to go about the important stuff in life. So including, you know, forming and maintaining those bonds. So those pulsed calls are actually most killer whale groups will actually have dialects that are unique to them, and they'll know who they are and who their family is because of the unique pulsed calls.
That's amazing, because I think it's when we began to understand whale sound that we really understood that the ocean is anything but silent. But I want to hear more sound. Here's one more.
Please.
Okay, that just sounds like a motorboat to me.
That is a plainfin midshipman fish, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, these are little fish. They're about 6 or 8 inches long. They live along the Puget Sound coast where I live in Victoria, British Columbia. And they have some of the fastest muscles of any vertebrate that we know of. And the males, every spring, so mostly they live out in the water. And every spring they come up, the males will come up on shore. They'll go under a rock, like right near the tide line, and they make a nest. And then the males will bulk up these special muscles that they have that are kind of bracketing their swim bladder, which is a kind of air-filled sac that they use to control their buoyancy. And then they just start to vibrate these muscles as long and as loud as they possibly can.
Wow.
And that sound is just them doing that. And they will do that for hours. And they start doing it about 10 p.m. and they go most of the evening. And it's to attract females, because the females will go to the loudest and like strongest male, and they'll deposit their eggs and then they leave. And like with most fish where there's parental care, it's actually the male who like guards the nest and like waits for the babies to grow up. And so they're finding the strongest male who can like keep their eggs safe for as long as possible.
So we were just listening to a mating ritual there.
We were just listening to, I know.
X-rated Sunday morning radio.
Well, I shouldn't anthropomorphize, but I kind of, whenever I think of plainfin midshipman fish, this image comes into my head of Luciano Pavarotti, like in the basis, like right at the bottom of like a big concert hall. Because that's kind of what these fish are doing. Like they're sitting in a car carved out spot in the rock under the side of the rock. And they're just like making this huge booming noise, trying to like project sound out into the ocean.
Okay, if you're just tuning in, this is Sunday Magazine. I'm Duncan McHugh, sitting in for Pia Chattopadhyay. Right now, I'm talking to science writer Amarina Kingdon about the underwater soundscape. She's the author of Sing Like Fish, How Sound Rules Life Underwater. Let's go back to something that's I found surprising for much of what we know about ocean sounds. The U.S. military is where we learned a lot about the ocean. How did this come about?
So war has always kind of been a big driver of technology, and in this case, that was absolutely true. And so essentially what happened was when German submarines and U-boats began to be a thing in World War I, there was this huge pressure to figure out how it was that we could listen underwater for submarines. Warfare went under the sea, and we had to start listening. And as I said, like, our ears don't work very well underwater. So if you just put a microphone underwater and put little headphones in your ears, I mean, you're just not going to hear very much. So World War I, or the Great War at the time, started in 1914. Right before that, the Titanic had actually sunk as well. So there had already been kind of this weird flurry of interest of how to figure out how to echo sound icebergs in the North Atlantic. And so there was just starting to be these inventions of how to use telegraph technology, adapt it for underwater to overcome that, like, human ears don't work very well, so we could actually start to hear what was actually down there. So World War I kind of spurred a lot of this technology, the beginnings of sonar technology. And then when you get to World War II, you really have this development of extensive hydrophone networks. And this was where we really started to understand that the ocean was very much not a silent world. Like, right away, if you put a hydrophone in the water, you're going to hear this kind of background roar of just waves and wind and bubbles and spray that just exists all over the place.
So the military is figuring that out, but they're not sharing it with the rest of us.
Well, exactly. So what if you're a sonar operator and you're listening for like a World War II or a Soviet submarine, and you're hearing these boop, boop noise, you have no idea what's making it, you need to find out what is in the ocean so you can tell your techs, hey, this is a problem, and hey, this is not a problem. And so some of the first real systematic scientific inquiries into what was in the water, and this was where we found out about fin whales and humpback whales. This is the first humpback whale song recordings. This is where we discovered snapping shrimp. The sonar techs would call it crackle.
because they're saying, hey, that's not a sub.
Exactly, because you didn't want to waste time and energy going after something that sounded, you know, threatening if you knew that it was a fin whale. And so there was this huge effort to catalog underwater what they called biologicals. But they kept a lot of these manuals and a lot of these lists and these categories classified for, you know, in some cases a few years, in some cases 50 years, until they just didn't want other countries to know what they knew about the underwater world.
Which is why we're a little late to the game about understanding how much impact human beings are having on the soundscape of the ocean. And we now know that we are having a huge impact. Can you tell us what is impacting the marine soundscape and how?
That's a complicated question. But the short answer is the more that you rely on sound to survive and to live your life, so to wayfind, to hunt, to escape from predators, to mate, to maintain your social bonds, the more you have to lose when you can't hear properly or when you can't make sounds the way that you need to. And so what we find when we start to study how animals underwater use sound in their daily lives, the more we start to see how it could impact them. So one of the first times that I kind of understood just how extensive these impacts could be was when I was assigned a story about cleaner wrasse, which are a little fish that live on coral reefs. And this was a study done in the South Pacific. And they're kind of like these little, they set up a station and they have like a symbiotic relationship with bigger fish. The bigger fish come by and they clean them and eat parasites off them. And in exchange, they don't get eaten themselves. And these scientists found that when there was motorboat noise from fishers or from, you know, tourists around the reef, that the cleaner wrasse would actually, I'm projecting here saying get irritated, but they would take more and more bites. They try to cheat more with this interaction, and then they get chased more. So there's more energy being expended. There's a different dynamic. And you start to see, oh, this has like real world knock-on impacts. And that's just with like motorboat noise slightly annoying a fish.
You talk about the noise, underwater noise being a trespass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, I mean, for listeners at home, if their neighbor is running, you know, his lawnmower right now,
mm-hmm.
that's distracting. distracting me from listening to the radio. But is this underwater noise more than just a distraction?
Yeah. So a lot of the regulation and a lot of the studies, again, in a scientific framework looking at this, is sort of looking at this as a zones of influence. So if you were to imagine a noise source at the center of sort of a nested series of spheres, right up close, you have an impact where you would just have, like, you know, injury or permanent hearing loss. And then you move a little bit further out and you enter a zone where you have maybe like a temporary, your ears are ringing. And then you move a little bit further out and you get into behavior changes. Further out, you can't communicate as well. Your communication space is shrunk. And further out from that, you can just hear it. And so as you start to look at all these different sorts of impacts and you start to understand how different animals perceive different sounds, at what frequencies, at what sensitivities, you start to see just how complex this can be. And one of the most profound sort of things that I learned while I was working on this book, I was up in Cook Inlet in Alaska, which, if you've never been there, the water is opaque. It's like a latte or like chocolate milk. And there's a pod of belugas that lives up there. And I was sitting on a boat watching these belugas bumping around underwater. I couldn't see them at all, but I could hear them making noises. And it was young belugas. It was very, very young animals. So they're still gray and they're still making goofy noises above the water. And the scientist that I was with, as we were watching the sort of fish finder device on our boat, all of a sudden this mother and calf go by underneath. And you can just see this like mother shape and this calf shape. And I just look at this water and I go, they cannot see each other at all. And then it occurs to me, man, whales don't have arms. They can't hold their babies. So we ended up talking about this. And he basically said, yeah, when whales, because they're mammals, they have these mammalian mother-calf bonds. When they're trying to stay close, the calf is dependent. They make little murmuring sounds to each other constantly. They're called contact calls. And basically, that's how they stay close. And if they get separated, it's very bad. And one of the things that noise can do underwater is if it impacts the ability of the mother and the calf to hear each other and they get separated, that's extremely bad for the calf.
You make the point in the book that, of shipping traffic in particular and how much that is interfering with marine sound. Big question here, but what about climate change? I mean, how is that impacting soundscape in the ocean?
Yeah, so I guess two answers to that. One is that it's climate change is just the big massive thing. I mean, I confess that I kind of felt a little bit at times when I was talking about underwater noise in this day and age, like I should probably be spending whatever energy I had looking at climate change, because in many ways that's the most direct threat that's happening in the ocean. But what I found was that it's never as simple as just one thing. There's always different things that are compounding each other. So it could be anything from, as water warms, sound moves through it differently. So it changes how the ocean layers move. It changes how they stratify. It changes how far sound can travel, which obviously would affect, you know, whales that send signals over long distances. It can also, as oceans acidify, they expect sound will travel at different speeds. Another thing that's sort of a different sort of impact is coral reefs. So around the world, wherever there's coral reefs, there's usually a lot of reef fish or corals or other what are called broadcast spawners, where they, you know, release a huge amount of eggs and gametes, and then all those animals come back to the reef and settle down. And there's been a huge amount of research that's shown that the sound of a healthy reef, so that's all those animals like bustling around and eating and chewing and moving, that draws those larvae back to the reef in order to settle and create another generation of healthy reef. When the reef is bleached or thanks to climate change, it's not there anymore, it gets quieter and it can't be that beacon of sound for all those animals, and it kind of helps accelerate that problem.
You make the case that the data is pretty clear here, that the noise hurts marine life. Canada has, you know, so much coastline, and I wonder, what are we doing here in Canada to protect ocean species from sound damage from caused by shipping or mining noise?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned mining noise, because that's a big one in the Arctic. Up in the Arctic, one of the biggest sources of shipping noise is actually supply ships and ships going in and out of resource extraction mines. Yet, like you said, Canada has a huge coastline. I believe that the Oceans Protections Plan, as part of that, there is a focus on ocean noise and ocean sound. I'm not sure if that's actually going to be binding resolution, though. One of the things that is tricky about ocean noise is that because shipping is an international industry, it's very difficult for one nation to go ahead and put some sort of, you know, regulation in place saying this, that, or the other thing. What we've also started to do is look at where our shipping lanes are. So there's some evidence that if you have a shipping lane and it goes through a particularly sensitive area to some animals, like say a breeding ground for whales or, you know, a breeding ground for another animal, if you move the shipping lane away from that area, you can reduce the conflict. And so that's under discussion. I know that there's been some movement of the shipping lane in the Strait of Juan de Fuca and also in the St. Lawrence Seaway. I think there's also some efforts to slow ships down as well. Slowing ships down is another huge thing. And I've heard from several different folks that I spoke to that Canada is actually doing more than a lot of other places in this area in trying to put programs in place where whenever there's whales in the area, if a ship slows down, it creates a lot less noise. Most of the noise actually comes out of its propeller. So if the propeller's spinning slower, then it just creates less noise. One of my favorite things about when I was listening to some noise from Oceans Networks Canada, which has a hydrophone network in the Strait of Georgia, one of the researchers there played me a ship that had a rope wrapped around the shaft of its propeller, and it was creating this huge high-pitched shrieking noise underwater, but we had no idea above the surface because we just don't hear that sort of noise. And so they were able to call the ship and say, hey, by the way, did you know that you have a huge like rope wrapped around your propeller? And they were like, oh, thanks. Thanks for letting us know. We'll get that off there. So if there is a ship that's, you know, problematic because it's got something like that or it's in poor repair, a hydrophone network can help to identify it. And one of the things about noise that I thought was, it's actually a technical term. Noise is unwanted sound that interferes with a signal. So one thing can be noise to one animal and not noise to another. So by definition, noise is something that is having an impact. And I think when you have species that are, you know, maybe already feeling stressed from various other issues or even just trying to go about their lives normally, if we can easily and quickly quiet down, which when it comes to sound is actually sometimes a little bit easier than, say, cleaning up an oil spill or plastics or whatnot, and we can, you know, take that additional pressure off of animals, I think we're, you know, not only doing the right thing, but we're also helping out animals that are facing a lot of other challenges as well.
Thank you for taking us on this tour underwater and joining us in the studio today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Amarina Kingdon is a science writer based in Victoria, BC. Her new book is called Sing Like Fish, How Sound Rules Life Underwater. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Duncan McHugh. Jimmy Guetch, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.